Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
I'm glad you downloaded the latest episode of Peter B. Collins Podcast. And this program is supported by subscribers, including Janet Imus, Frank Barbara, Pauline Nixon, a Nixon, and Ira Scott. During April, we're trying to double our subscriber base, and I need your help. We're offering free copies of Hank Albarelli's book, A Terrible Mistake, signed by the author, to new subscribers at the $50 annual level or $10 a month or greater. And if you sign up for the baseline subscription at $5 a month, we're going to draw five names at the end of the month to win a free book. So please spread the word far and wide and help people find us here at peterbcollins.com. Today we talk about torture, American style, and one of the vendors who offered torture to the Bush administration in Egypt, Omar Suleiman. Here's Michael Franti and Spearhead. This is called Yell Fire.
A revolution never comes with a warning. A revolution never sends you an omen. A revolution just arrived like the morning. Ring the alarm, we come to wake up the snoring. They're telling you to never worry about the future. They're telling you to never worry about the torture.
That's right, they're telling you to never worry about the torture. Professor Lisa Hajar returns to our program today. She teaches sociology at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and has been on our program many times in the past. She went to Guantanamo to cover the Omar Khadr trial, and we'll talk about his situation a little bit later on. Professor, welcome back to our program.
Thank you for inviting me, Peter.
And Omar Suleiman is a really dark but fascinating character. He was the man who managed the dictatorship of the Mubarak family in Egypt. And when Mubarak hit the rocks with the so-called Arab Spring, one of his first moves was to try to install Omar Suleiman as his instant vice president. There had been no position because Mubarak feared that anybody in second place might attempt to depose him. And Suleiman was the guy who ran the Mukhabarat, and that is the Interior Department in Egypt. Their building was destroyed and ransacked by the protesters in January of 2011. And when Mubarak tried to hand off power to Suleiman, the Obama administration and Secretary of State Clinton immediately fell in line and said, yeah, that's the way forward in Egypt. And then those in Tahrir Square said no, and it appeared that the military junta running Egypt then decided that Suleiman was too toxic, and he disappeared for over a year. Now he has resurfaced as a candidate for president of Egypt very late in that process. So first let's talk about his history, because Suleiman truly is a torturer, and not just somebody who directed torture programs, but took personal pleasure in being a torturer himself.
Yes. Well, one, with Suleiman's role, you know, up until his very, as you noted, brief term as vice president, was he was the head of the general, the Egyptian General Intelligence Service. So that was actually the equivalent of Egypt's version of the CIA, but it was, you know, coming out of the military rather than, you know, the CIA here as a civilian institution. He, so part of his history was in the 1990s under the Clinton administration. I mean, he's had very close ties with Washington, and particularly with the CIA, but with other branches of the U.S. government. In the 1990s, when the Clinton administration instituted a new program called the Rendition Program, it was done very much in conjunction with Egypt. And the Rendition Program under Clinton involved arresting or kidnapping people mm-hmm. and then returning them to their home country or to a third country, but to stand trial. And so a number of Islamists, I mean, including Egyptian Islamists who had fled Egypt and were in the Balkans, were picked up and then returned to Egypt to be tried in the late 1990s. So that was all part of under Suleiman's authority. When the Bush administration then instituted extraordinary rendition, which involved kidnapping people and either disappearing them into CIA black sites or transferring them to countries for what we can, you know, earnestly and, you know, intelligently say is torture by proxy, you know, Egypt was one of the favorite destinations, and largely because of the fact that Suleiman was quite willing to collaborate with the Bush administration, and he did so in a number of cases of people who were transferred, you know, from CIA custody into Egypt for a period of interrogation.
Right. And when I refer to him as a vendor, I am speculating, but given that all this stuff is covert, I would imagine that there were cash payments either to the government of Egypt or to Suleiman individually for managing these torture programs for the United States. And I'm glad that you correctly cite that rendition began under Clinton.
Right. Well, I don't know what the financial arrangements would be, but certainly Egypt, as the second largest, you know, recipient of U.S. foreign aid, you know, tied in amount to the amount that the United States gives to Israel. I mean, certainly that, a great deal of that, you know, billions every year would go into the military. And so Suleiman certainly had access to U.S. funding, at least through that regard, as running one, you know, institution under the, you know, the Egyptian military umbrella.
Mm-hmm. And talk a little bit about the specifics of the case of al-Libi, because his blindfold came off during a torture session, and he actually laid eyes on his torturer and has identified him as Omar Suleiman himself.
Yeah, actually, the person whose blindfold came off was the Australian citizen of Egyptian origin, Mamdou Habib. And in you know, when Habib was picked up in Pakistan, probably sold for bounty, you know, went to a CIA black site, but then ended up in Egypt. And indeed, Suleiman personally tortured Habib. And in fact, you know, Habib was subsequently repatriated back to Australia after the story of his torture was revealed by Dana Priest in the Washington Post. And he has, you know, initiated, and there is, in fact, ongoing efforts to pursue some kind of suit against Suleiman personally, although that would obviously be stymied if Suleiman becomes president. But the case of al-Libi, in fact, is much more significant globally. I mean, al-Libi was a was not a member of al-Qaeda. He was somebody who had gone to Afghanistan in the 1990s as part of, you know, this wave of Arabs who went there to, you know, initially wage jihad and you know, to evict the Soviets, and then sort of stayed on as part of that. So al-Libi had run a militant training camp called the Khaldan camp, and when the U.S. Invasion of Afghanistan began in the fall of 2001, like many others, al-Libi was fleeing across the border to Pakistan. He was picked up, was extraordinarily rendered to the USS Bataan, which had a secret CIA black site on it, And somewhere either between there or Bagram, under torture, Libby had hinted at, you know, was being questioned about and hinted at the idea that there might be a connection between Al-Qaeda and the regime of Saddam Hussein. And this was something that the United States in the winter of 2003 was desperate to get that kind of information because, you know, the wheels of going to war against Iraq were churning, but there needed to be some way of rationalizing how to, you know, sell that war both to Americans and to reluctant allies.
Mm-hmm.
So Libby was then shipped to Egypt, where he was tortured, and of course, under the program, you know, whether Suleiman was directly involved or not, we don't know, but it would have been under Suleiman's authority. And in that period, under brutal torture, he then, quote, confessed to saying basically that there were two Al-Qaeda operatives who had received chemical weapons training from the regime of Saddam Hussein. That statement was false, and Libby subsequently recanted it, you know, afterwards. But it was the statement that then Secretary of State Colin Powell used, one of two pieces of both, you know, ultimately false information that were used to at the presentation at the United Nations to get an endorsement for the invasion of Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Libby then subsequently disappears. Nobody knew where he was, but it was known then that, you know, in fact, his statement had been tortured and was false. I mean, that information came out, and it was became clear, you know, as the, you know, war and occupation of Iraq went on. It was then, you know, interestingly enough, in April of 2009, some Human Rights Watch investigators were in Libya, you know, doing a report on prison conditions in Libya. And there they were surprised to encounter Ibn al-Sheikh al-Libi in a prison outside of Tripoli. And so as soon as, you know, they made it public that al-Libi was alive, he was in Libya, you know, there was, you know, immediate moves to try and have access to him, to talk to him about his experience. And, you know, given that the Iraq war had been based on, you know, partially on a statement he had made, the following month, before anybody could access him, Omar Suleiman flies from Egypt to Libya to meet with his counterpart. And by the time Suleiman's plane is alighting back to return to Egypt, Ibn al-Sheikh al-Libi had committed, quote, suicide in his cell. And so, you know, evidence destroyed of both his torture and the falseness of his tortured statement.
And I'll note that the other critical information, I would use air quotes around the term evidence, that was presented by Colin Powell at the United Nations February 6, 2003, has been recanted by the guy known as Curveball in a British television interview about 2 weeks ago. He acknowledged that his commentary and information that was supplied to the Americans about alleged mobile weapons labs of Saddam Hussein was completely false. And so with that, we see even greater outlines of the deception used to take America to war in a war of choice. And we'll come back to that a little bit later when we talk about torture issues and the culpability of members of the Bush administration right up to Bush and Cheney themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But, Professor, where has Suleiman been? He dropped out of sight shortly after it became clear that his service as vice president was not needed or wanted following the deposing of Mubarak. And I'm wondering, did Baby Doc loan him his exile villa on the Riviera in France? Because he went back to Haiti and I guess isn't occupying that anymore.
Right. Well, I think that Suleiman remained in Egypt. And I don't actually know what kind of power he was exercising in the period, you know, once the Supreme Council for the Armed Forces, or SCAF, took over. But certainly, you know, in the Egyptian context, you know, he doesn't have the illegitimacy, you know, that one might expect, partially because, you know, much of what he had done in the previous decades was much more focused, you know, external to Egypt. I mean, he was a regional type of a player. So he was really managing Egypt's, you know, intelligence and, you know, relations regionally. He, for example, was, you know, very close with the Israeli authorities. He was an ardent anti-Islamist.
Mm-hmm.
So one could think that he was, you know, just remaining within Egypt. And certainly he's one of many of the members of the military who's profiteered, you know, from their military positions on, you know, in the Egyptian economy.
Now I certainly understand his utility to Israel, the United States, and others in the region. But isn't it fair to say that he's a marked man, given that the Muslim Brotherhood is running at about 50% in the parliament and in the polls for this presidential election? And, you know, they were subjected to decades of torture by Suleiman and his predecessors. So doesn't that, I mean, are their memories that short, or have people moved on from the Mubarak period and just etch-a-sketch that away?
Well, I think, you know, in fact, this is exactly what a key to understanding why Suleiman has recently been, I mean, the way he's presenting it is that he's been recruited, I mean, you know, reluctant to run, had no intention of running, but was responding to the call of people who wanted him to run. And one of the very significant reasons is that it's very clear, for a variety of reasons we can talk about, that, I mean, the Muslim Brothers swept the legislative elections, and the Muslim Brothers candidate, al-Shatir, certainly has a strong chance of winning the presidency. And so I think, you know, people in Egypt, particularly those who absolutely do not want to see a kind of Islamist-dominated government, look to Suleiman as famously anti-Islamist and coming out of the military. And he doesn't have the same kind of corrupt reputation, although he certainly profiteered, but he doesn't have the same kind of corrupt reputation as some other members of the, you know, former Mubarak regime. So he's really seen as an alternative, I mean, a clear alternative to the Islamists. But what he also represents, I think, is for those, you know, Egyptians who either still endorse and trust the military, you know, seeing, you know, him coming out of the military is something that would give him credibility among those people. And also, I just think, you know, maybe people who are, you know, did not support the revolution, people or people who just look at this ongoing instability of revolutionary fervor as something that they just want to do away with. And so in that regard, Suleiman really represents, you know, return to the status quo ante kind of a candidate.
But it seems chilling to imagine that the choices are those stark. I certainly understand the fear of the Muslim Brotherhood. I see it fanned on a regular basis by Zionists in the United States. My bottom line is self-determination, that the Egyptian people deserve to choose their own leadership. And I see meddling by the United States and by Israel in this promotion of Suleiman as the stark alternative to the Muslim Brotherhood and al-Shatir. And, you know, my sense is, and, you know, I'm certainly not an expert on the complexities of Egyptian politics, but it seems to me that those who put their lives on the line, including women, who had to step out, and many were subjected to these ugly virginity tests by representatives of the military during the protests over the past year, it's hard to imagine that they could be consigned into accepting Suleiman simply as, you know, the least worst alternative to the Muslim Brotherhood.
Yeah, no, I mean, in fact, I think that, you know, the sectors of Egyptian society that might see Suleiman as, you know, a good candidate in a field that has, I believe, 24 people running are, you know, a very particular kind of slice of Egyptian society. You know, the real problem, I think, from a, you know, either a feminist perspective, from a real revolutionary perspective, is that the speed at which the SCAF move forward, you know, partially there was this, you know, really desire to get the military out of its role as a junta, but also, you know, clearly the timing, the quick timing of the elections and so on, you know, was designed to not enable enough time for the formation of new political parties, particularly those that really represent a more youthful, a more secular, a more revolutionary sentiment. And so, you know, the top contenders in this field are, you know, someone like Suleiman, who represents the ancient regime, and the military, Shatter, who, you know, comes out of the Muslim Brothers, which is a very well-established and entrenched organization with a lot of organizational muscle. Then you've got like Amr Moussa, who also served as, you know, in the Mubarak regime, but as a foreign minister, and then was the head of the Arab League. What I understand coming out of Egypt now is that, you know, for lack of better alternatives, Amr Moussa will probably gain the support of people, you know, women and, you know, feminists and secularists, etc. But, you know, it's going to be, you know, it'll be interesting to see, you know, how it will shake out. But the presidential election is May 23rd and 24th. And Suleiman just threw his hat into the ring so recently that I haven't yet seen polling data on, you know, how the current lineup of contenders is polling, you know, for prospects for the election. But you're absolutely right. I mean, the United States would be very comfortable, you know, the U.S. government would be very comfortable with Suleiman. He's been, you know, a real interface between the, you know, Mubarak regime and the Egyptian military with the U.S. I think Benjamin Netanyahu has endorsed Suleiman for president because, you know, he had, you know, been very close collaborator with Israel in, you know, dealing with Hamas, the Hamas government in Gaza. You know, Suleiman was responsible for, you know, trying to close down and blow up tunnels and et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, in that regard also, you know, that's another detraction from Suleiman's appeal among a broader sector of Egyptian society is the fact that he's seen as very close to Israel. And that's been one of, you know, a real grievance for many Egyptians, is that, you know, many people do not accept the principle of normalization, do not accept the policies that Israel has instituted, you know, in, against Palestinians, particularly those in Gaza. So, you know, what we're seeing is a very complicated and diverse set of interests among the Egyptian electorate. And Suleiman sort of speaks to one particular segment.
And what do you make of the U.S. posture recently? Because we included in legislation last year that any additional payments to the Egyptian government under the $1.5 billion annual peace commitment that came out of, what, Camp David in the late 1980s?
The
70s. Goes back that far. Thank you. That we had to certify that they were, I don't know the exact language, but on a path to, you know, observing international human rights standards. And we have authorized the next payment from that fund really based on simply their backing down on holding the so-called democracy activists, including the son of Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood. And so when Egypt released those, it appears that we essentially agreed to ransom payments in the form of releasing the money that otherwise should have been held back because Egypt clearly doesn't meet the standards articulated in the legislation.
Right. Well, I mean, yeah, the United States position is, you know, notoriously and elaborately hypocritical in those regards. And so to some extent, the United States has a vested interest in, you know, one could say at the most basic level, stability in Egypt. And certainly the U.S. government regards the Egyptian military as a highly stabilizing force in general, although, yeah, as you noted, that, you know, temporary arrest of U.S. U.S. agents who were operating in Egypt was almost an aberration. But like, look at the U.S. policy vis-a-vis Bahrain. I mean, the Bahraini regime has been engaging in astoundingly illegal behavior vis-a-vis protesters and the prosecution of doctors. And we've, you know, increased spending, sent arms, reinforced our alliance because, you know, the Fifth Fleet docks in Bahrain. So there's no sense of, you know, coherent and cohesive commitment to any principles, let alone those of international law, observation, and enforcement.
Well, indeed, and Syria is just another example of the, at minimum, we have uneven standards for support or, you know, calling for the removal of different types of dictators. And you're correct that the royal families in both Bahrain and Saudi Arabia are in a special category that rises above any petty concerns about human rights and self-determination. I note I don't use the term democracy. I'm not expecting democracy to spring up in these nations, but I do think that as an American standard, that if we make self-determination the real, you know, critical defining issue, that it would serve our interests going forward much better than the way we're ducking and weaving and saying, well, we support a dictator here, but not over here. And, you know, to essentially install Suleiman as the next Mubarak in Egypt is an affront to virtually all concerned.
You know, I totally agree with you. And I think that, I mean, whether or not Suleiman really has a fighting chance against the Muslim Brother candidate remains to be seen. But in some sense, you know, the United States, I mean, just given the U.S. reputation, you know, throughout the region, it's almost, poisonous for the United States to endorse anyone, because that would actually probably add to that person's illegitimacy in contention.
Well, but I also think beyond that perception that it's important for us not to tip our hands and not to anoint people, because I think it will only make things complicated in the years ahead.
Right. Yeah, no, I agree. And I think certainly the issue, the prospect of a Muslim Brotherhood-dominated legislature and the presidency is something that, you know, the Americans are, you know, U.S. government officials are certainly deeply anxious about, because, you know, that will signal, at least in the short to medium term, probably rather significant changes in Egypt's policies, ones that the United States would not favor at all. You know, I mean, not least of which would be, you know, rethinking Egypt's relationship with Israel, at least to some extent, and support and increasing support for Palestinians. So, you know, I imagine that the United States is foregoing all other considerations, you know, over the anxiety of that prospect of an Islamist-dominated Egyptian government.
Lisa, I want to move to issues related to Guantanamo. Is there anything else you'd like to comment on related to Egypt and this reappearance of Omar Suleiman?
Well, the only thing I would say is, you know, that, and you had mentioned Saudi Arabia before, the you know, second only to the Muslim Brothers, the showing of the Muslim Brothers in the legislative elections was the showing of the Salafis, which are a much more radical ideological perspective on Islam. And they are, you know, many of them, you know, the people who are, you know, Salafis themselves either, you know, worked in Saudi Arabia, were influenced by Wahhabi religiosity, or, you know, are influenced by those who did. And Saudi Arabia has been pumping a huge amount of money into Egypt to endorse Salafis in the coming elections, and certainly they have a strong presence in the parliament along with the Muslim Brothers. So that's just one more element that there's a lot of hands are going into the pot of Egyptian electioneering.
And before we go to the torture and detention issues at Guantanamo, may I ask you just for a quick comment on the conflict in Syria? Because as it's presented by the corporate media in this country, it's just this ugly dictator with his brutal military shelling residential communities in cities like Homs and others around the nation. And I see this as a much more complicated picture with U.S. forces, covert forces, clearly in Turkey and Jordan and probably inside Syria, and that they're really is a containment strategy mostly focused on Iran, and that Syria is really, in some ways, a proxy conflict where the tensions with Iran are being played out.
Yeah, well, I think that certainly the United States sees Syria through an Iran-focused lens, and it is extraordinarily complicated in Syria. And my family background traces back to Syria, and I have a number of segments of my family, you know, going back to my grandfather's side of the family, still in Syria. They're Christians. My relatives are, you know, strong endorsers like many Christians, like the Christian community, like the Alawi community of the regime, because they really are buying the story that, you know, the revolution or you know, the unrest in Syria is entirely, you know, basically terrorist organizations, it's, you know, Al-Qaeda. The thing that's going on, and Syria is a much more complex society, ethnically, religiously, and so on, and, mm-hmm. and the regime has a lot of support. The regime also has a lot of opponents. So certainly there is a strong Muslim Brothers opposition. There may, in fact, be Al-Qaeda, you know, elements within Syria.
Wait a minute.
Human rights, you know, segment, a real anti-authoritarian.
But Lisa, excuse me, this is one of these rare moments where Ayman al-Zawahiri, the now leader of Al-Qaeda, since we officially accept the departure of Osama bin Laden, has weighed in essentially on the side of the United States. He is against the Assad regime.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, you know, so in that regard, you know, it's not as simple like, you know, I mean, or the sides, you know, my enemy of my enemy is my friend in
right.
kind of situation.
Yeah.
And so certainly the United States is arming the opposition now covertly and is certainly, you know, engaged in, you know, in efforts to try and negotiate a ceasefire, et cetera. And U.S. official statements have consistently been that it's simply a matter of time, you know, when and how will Bashar al-Assad step down? I mean, to the extent that Syria is, you know, the Syrian regime, it's you know, dominated by an Alawi minority. I mean, they, too, for their own reasons, are, you know, deeply anti-Islamist of the kind that al-Qaeda represents and of the kind that the United States fears. And so in that sense, you know, if there's some of those segments in the opposition, then the U.S. and al-Qaeda have common interests.
Right. All right, one more on Syria. The Free Syrian Army, is it comprised solely of defectors from Assad's army, or is it augmented by paid foreign fighters aligned with outside interests, possibly including the United States?
I don't actually, to be honest with you, I don't know if there are paid foreign fighters now. My sense is that those who are, you know, operating under the, you know, banner of the Free Syrian Army are a combination of people who came together, you know, to defend their own neighborhoods against, you know, the regime's onslaughts and military defectors. So you've got sort of, you know, citizen militia types that have come together and are, you know, mainly concentrated in terms of how they're operating within different localities, and then the defectors are, you know, providing a bit of military, you know, training and direction.
All right, I lied. I have one more. What about Danny, the British citizen of Syrian ancestry, who has appeared in the United States? He showed up the same week that the Joseph Kony video surfaced. And he's demanding U.S. military intervention into Syria. And I regard him as a propagandist on the order of the Kuwaiti ambassador's daughter who told us about the Iraqis who were throwing babies out of incubators back in 1993.
You know what? I will go along with your analysis. I haven't followed the case very closely, but that sounds totally plausible to me.
All right. Well, Google him and take a look, because he enjoyed a media blitz for about a week or 10 days and was unchallenged in his call. He said, people are dying there. Therefore, the United States should immediately intervene militarily. And it just struck me as agitprop of the most obvious dimensions. Mm. So let me now turn to issues, and I do appreciate the work that you've done, including spending time at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, over the last few years. And the Obama administration has conceded to its opponents, including members of the Democratic leadership in the Senate, and is not going to attempt to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and his four alleged collaborators on the 9/11 attacks in a federal courtroom in New York. Instead, they're firing up these kangaroo courts, the military tribunals at Guantanamo, whose work that you've observed in the past. And we know from Morris Davis that these are rigged, that these are show trials that cannot have an outcome of acquittal. We also know that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed wants to be martyred, and has acknowledged responsibility for things that he probably was not responsible for. So given that backdrop, I see this as purely a show trial for consumption during a political election year. Your comment?
Well, I think that, I mean, many of the some of the military lawyers who are working, you know, in the Office of Military Commission Defense presume, I think, on a well-established basis, that the timing of the charging and arraignment of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the other four people who will be facing charges for 9/11, this timing to coincide with the one-year anniversary of the, you know, the killing of Osama bin Laden and the about-to-be-published autobiography of Jose Rodriguez, who was, you know, a lawyer for the CIA. Mm-hmm. Those two events, I mean, this is another element of it. And people think it is, actually, this timing is, you know, at least to some extent, you know, tweaked towards the election.
Well, and let me just add one more element, and that is that there is a movie in production in Hollywood scheduled for release in September or October, based on the story of SEAL Team 6's raid on Abbottabad, Pakistan. And there's no accident in the timing of that either.
Right. Yeah, I mean, this is certainly, you know, these are all ways of, you know, portraying the Obama administration as, you know, tough on terror and you know, dealing with, you know, sort of having, you know, a strength in national security that, you know, contrasts to Romney's lack of experience in those areas.
Mm-hmm. So with the arraignment of KSM, how do you see a timeline on these proceedings? And will they actually hold hearings and the central part of the trial this year? Or are we just going to be teased with preliminaries?
I think we'll be teased with preliminaries. Right now, what's going on, just to, you know, suggest that, you know, the military commissions themselves are, you know, they've been made and remade and tweaked, and there's still a constant pressure operating within the system just to even, you know, look even the slightest way, you know, rational and realistic. So right now, in the ongoing process of prosecuting Abdulrashim al-Nashiri, who's accused of being the mastermind of the bombing of the USS Cole in 2000, there's a you know, a First Amendment lawyer is down there and for the first time has gotten the right to testify before the judge in that case on the grounds that the government wanted to close a hearing to the media about, you know, whether or not al-Nashiri needed to be shackled while he was meeting with his own lawyers, because the argument that the lawyers were planning on making was to say that shackling Nashiri was debilitating to him because of the treatment he'd been subjected to in CIA custody, you know, previously. And the fact that, you know, I mean, al-Nashiri is one of the three people who was most brutally tortured, and he was one of the subjects of the videotapes that the CIA subsequently destroyed. So mm-hmm. The government, in order to not have a discussion about his treatment, which the lawyers were planning on interjecting into that hearing, the government closed that hearing, and now there's a First Amendment lawyer, David Schultz, down there arguing that it's illegitimate to close those hearings, especially since, you know, al-Nashiri's treatment is public knowledge by now.
Well, as public is the 183 waterboarding episodes applied to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed.
Right.
And this, of course, presents the need for the government to sidestep the issues of torture, sidestep the hearsay status of testimony derived from torture and its general unreliability. And I want to credit Spencer Ackerman, who writes for Wired and other publications, because in a piece that he recently published, he connected dots between the plea bargain of Majid Khan and the forthcoming military commission trials of KSM and his associates. And he argues that by flipping Khan and using his testimony against KSM, that this may permit the government to avoid even touching matters related to torture or evidence derived from it in attempting to move forward to a conviction that is already ordained.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that is absolutely a very excellent way of understanding what's moving forward. Even during the Bush administration, when the 9/11 guys were arraigned the first time and they went into a hearing, it was in November of 2008, after the election. So Bush was already a lame duck, but it was, you know, a month and a half before Obama took office. And at that arraignment, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed basically stood up and said he was willing to plead guilty and go straight to sentencing and accept the death penalty. You know, that was, he was willing to do that without a trial. You know, from one point of view, that was, you know, in fact, the judge didn't actually know what to do at the time.
Yeah.
You know, so the judge, you know, and there was sort of an, for some unknown reason, was an inconceivable proposition. But in the end, you know, essentially it would have been suicide by military commission. They did not do that. But certainly, you know, if KSM at least, and whether or not the other four would go along with it, if KSM would agree to a plea bargain under similar circumstances, that he doesn't need a trial. He doesn't, you know, what he really wants is to be executed. So he has no interest in using the trial as a way of exposing U.S. torture, but his lawyers do. And so this is where you get into some of the very complicated ways in which the legal process in any court system works, where, you know, the interest of law and the interest of using a trial for purposes in addition to its specific purpose, and in this case, to really expose the degree to which U.S. Agents engaged in torture, is not the same interest that the client may have.
Well, and that's a very good point. And as you use that term, suicide by military commission, our political interests won't permit that. Yet the same political interest led to the killing of Osama bin Laden without any evident attempt to detain him and to learn what he knew or what he could tell us about the Al-Qaeda network, about 9/11, about many other incidents that he is blamed for and probably quite responsible for. I make no brief on behalf of Osama bin Laden, but it is curious that we chose not to detain him in any manner, to simply execute him, and we claim we destroyed the body. There's an alternate story that was actually brought back to Dover for detailed autopsies here in the United States. I can't prove that, but it does play to my own suspicions. At any rate, it is curious that we're not interested in getting to the bottom of these issues or even learning how American officials and systems have failed us in these terrorist attacks over the years. But we are most interested in you know, creating a show trial and serving up a predetermined guilty verdict as some demonstration of America's commitment to law and justice.
Right. I mean, you know, in fact, the argument that I and others hold, I've published about this a few times in Jedalia and Al Jazeera English, is that the cost, the political cost exacted through the various kinds of litigation challenging U.S. interrogation, including torture, challenging the legality of our detention policies, has made it, you know, for the Obama administration, who canceled torture, it's become much more politically costly and almost impossible to arrest people in a manner that comports with, you know, at least some of the principles Obama, you know, claims to hold, which is the closing of Guantanamo and, you know, a maintenance of the end of torture. So, in fact, I think that there's a direct correlation between the dramatic increase in targeted killing, because, in fact, nobody new has been taken into U.S. custody. I mean, now the policy is to forfeit whatever intelligence might be gathered because of the complexities of where are we going to hold them, what interrogation methods are we going to be using. It's just much easier to kill people, and I think Osama bin Laden is the, you know, primary example of that.
Well, and when we took out Anwar al-Awlaki and then his two children in drone strikes in Yemen, we lost the Fifth Amendment. And, you know, that to me is critical. I don't concede the expediency of killing al-Awlaki, who we've seen no evidence of his direct complicity in terrorist attacks. He certainly advocated for jihad. He met with individuals, including this Abdul Muttalib, the underwear bomber who flew in Detroit on Christmas Day. But no evidence has been presented of any compelling nature to establish him even as a suspect. And so to take him out in that manner was a matter of political expedience and a great cost to our Bill of Rights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, in fact, the irony is that Anwar al-Awlaki was never indicted for anything. He was never charged with anything. And he was killed, you know, in a literally extrajudicial manner, with an extrajudicial execution, whereas the government now can't even, you know, well, at least technically, legally, can't wiretap people without a warrant, but there's no warrant that's needed to kill people.
Well,
so
that was
a very, you know, legally dubious situation now.
And Michael Hayden, the former chief of intelligence, he stated that publicly. He said, wow, we needed a warrant to wiretap al-Awlaki, but it didn't take any piece of paper to kill him.
Right. Yeah. Given the political environment in the United States, there doesn't appear to be any possibility for rectifying this state of affairs in the immediate future.
Yeah. Now, Lisa, let's turn to the case that you covered at Guantanamo, the trial of the young man who was detained as a teenager, Omar Khadr, a Canadian national whose father took him to Afghanistan. And as he tells the story, he was in the midst of a firefight. An American was killed, and that became this kind of above the law case that made Khadr more than an average suspect, even despite his age. So we have a tribunal. He plea bargained, and part of that deal was he was to be permitted to return to Canada to complete his sentence. And as I understand it, he is still stranded at Guantanamo. Am I right?
That's right. I mean, in fact, there were diplomatic assurances that were part of the negotiations of the plea bargain. The assurances basically was, you know, specifically that Khadr would have a right to petition for his repatriation after one year of serving his post-conviction sentence, and that the Canadian government would, accept that request. The understanding, which was not so much in black and white, was that the Canadian government would actually agree to it. And so consequently, for probably domestic reasons in Canada and the fact that there's a right-wing government in power, they don't have a real interest in actually honoring their, so the request has been made, but they haven't actually honored it. And, it is their discretion to accept or not accept the request. So that is, in some ways, the complexity of the issue. I think the presumption is that, the Obama administration does want to see Omar Khadr out of Guantanamo and back to Canada. So there probably is some degree of diplomatic pressure being brought to bear on Canada. But Canada has its own, the Canadian regime has its own, sort of domestic interests to consider. And the Khadr family is quite loathed, among sectors of the public. And while there may be a lot of sympathy for Omar Khadr, the family as in general, they're called Canada's Al-Qaeda. But, so there's not a huge, powerful constituency demanding that the government, honor its agreement and repatriate Omar Khadr.
Last fall, I was in touch with you because I was contacted by the producers of a documentary, I believe they were Canadians, about Khadr. And it was based on footage of an interrogation that was conducted at Guantanamo when he was visited by two Canadian spooks, whom he at first thought were allies who were there to help him, and then realized that they were simply fronting for Americans, again asking him the same questions that he had been answering for years. And they never followed through. I was going to hook up an interview with you and one of the producers of the film, and I haven't seen anything further about it. Do you know if it got any distribution and has been seen by more than a handful of people?
I think at this stage, to my knowledge, I've seen the film. I saw it a while ago. I think it's still at the festival phase. So, when it actually gets perhaps bought up and by a distributor as a documentary film, we'll start seeing it. But it's a very interesting film, and it's one I think that hopefully when it does become available, even if it's, you know, on Netflix or whatever, that Americans will have a look at it. So, I mean, I think the whole Cotter story is a very, I mean, even among all the, every case in you know, Guantanamo has its own uniqueness. The Cotter case has been one that is so incredibly unique in several specific ways. One is the fact that he was, you know, a child when he was arrested. He was subjected to torture. But the other one, as you had mentioned, of the charges against him that he ultimately plea bargained guilty with are unlike any charges that anyone else at Guantanamo faces, namely a hot war violation. And so it really is a manifestation of the way the U.S. government has reinterpreted the laws of war to make the killing of a soldier a war crime. You know, it's not killing a soldier in a battle, no matter who the killer is not a war crime. I mean, a killer can be prosecuted criminally, but it does not constitute a war crime under any natural or normal understandings of the laws of war. But we have reinterpreted the laws of war in order to make it a war crime, in order singularly to prosecute Omar Khadr.
Well, and it's a new and bizarre extension of American exceptionalism, which essentially said that there is a super premium value on the life of an American soldier. And this puts aside the fact that we invaded Afghanistan, and you know, I don't know that we explicitly declared war, but we sent our troops in there, and this kid is caught in a firefight, and the explanation in the film is that he was actually injured and unable to commit the offenses against this American soldier that he is accused of.
Right. You know, I mean, I think that, you know, several things happened that, you know, he, because of the brutality of his interrogation treatment, both at Bagram and at Guantanamo when he first got there, you know, he started making statements, you know, either under torture or under pressure and fear, that subsequently could never go away. And whether or not they were actually true, he doesn't have, according to his own lawyers, much of a recollection. I mean, he was severely injured in the firefight during which the soldier was killed, and he was, you know, sort of the last man standing, and so they hung the charges on him. But he ultimately pled guilty because that was the only way he could, you know, foreseeably get out of Guantanamo, and, you know, was, his lawyers were loath to leave it to the discretion of a military jury, and particularly since the military judge overseeing the case, you know, allowed all those statements in on the grounds that the judge saw no evidence that, you know, that the statements were the result of torture. So the defense was under severe disadvantage. And again, like in many criminal proceedings, plea bargaining is often the preferred way to end a case. And, you know, that was the case here. But, you know, and so he indeed had to then go through the motions of taking responsibility for every act he was charged with and pled guilty to. But, you know, whether or not he really, really, really did it, that one will never be known.
Professor Hajjar, finally, I wanted to get your thoughts about an unusual case that looms for the future here in the United States, and that is that the European Court of Human Rights ruled recently that a British citizen named Abu Hamza al-Masri, who is better known as the one-eyed fiery cleric at the Finsbury Park Mosque in London, has been cleared for extradition to the United States. He's already served time in Britain. And what is curious here is that the deal that has been struck would send this imam to the Supermax prison in Colorado and not to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. It also appears to stipulate that he would be tried in American courts in the United States, and again, not before a military commission at Guantanamo. I actually favor these standards or protocols, but of course, I'm out of sync with the leaders of Congress, including many Democrats, who have tied the president's hands, and most recently in the draconian NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act for 2012, which included the language permitting the detention of American citizens. But in there were other clauses that basically don't permit the president to bring suspects, terror suspects, onto American soil or into American courts. Now, I know there are some exceptions in there, But it strikes me that this is challenging the misguided will of Congress in a way that sets up a potential interesting fight between the executive and legislative branches.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the added... Well, I think what you said is actually true. It'll be interesting to see if there's any blowback from this. But this particular case, I mean, it raises two other kinds of issues. One, first of all, the extradition of Al-Mashri and the other four people is, you know, like any extradition, is the result of diplomatic negotiations. So in that regard, the executive branch has, you know, complete discretion over foreign relations in that regard. So, you know, I mean, and specifically, you know, Britain as a member of the European community, you know, and subject to rigorous international laws, unlike the United States, had limited discretion. So under no circumstances would the extradition even have been conceivable had it not been for the option of sending these people into the United States to conventional prisons and a federal trial. However, where I think the European Court of Human Rights really is lowering its own standards, you know, many people have accused conditions, even in supermaxes, as at minimum cruel and unusual punishment, particularly protracted isolation. That was part of what was litigated, and the European Court of Human Rights basically said that they don't regard those conditions as cruel and unusual, and that's what opened the door to enable Britain to go forward with its extradition.
But the U.S. also forego the death penalty in this exchange.
Right. That's part of, you know, because the death penalty is outlawed in Europe, and so European governments are subject to these standards, and they can't agree to do anything that violates those standards.
And do you have any information that this British Al-Mashri is the one who was on the watch list that caused, I believe, the German citizen Khalid Al-Mashri to be taken into American custody, tortured, rendered, I think he was sent to Syria, and ultimately we dropped him off on a road somewhere and said good luck to him.
Al-Mashri, as you said, the German citizen, he wasn't the one who ended up in Syria. That was Maher Arar. He was kidnapped and then ended up in a black site in Afghanistan, and then they realized who it was. But no, I believe, I mean, Al-Mashri is a fairly common, you know, Lebanese name, but in fact, the person that, you know, the Khalid Al-Mashri, the German guy, was mistaken for was another Khalid Al-Mashri. You know, again, so like Al-Mashri is a fairly common name.
Okay. Well, Professor, I want to thank you for your time today and a very interesting conversation. I learned a lot, and I hope our listeners did as well.
Thank you very much.
Lisa Hajar from the University of California, Santa Barbara. Another day and more darkness about our United States of America. Thanks for listening.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds if we're together?